Hello and welcome to the Debate at GO8 podcast series. Today we're talking to cancer researcher Associate Professor Susan Woods about an Australian medical breakthrough that could lead to the eradication of bowel cancer, spell the end of awkward stool tests, and lead to earlier diagnosis, saving thousands of lives. GO8 researchers at the University of Adelaide have discovered a new way to detect bowel cancer using engineered bacteria, which can capture DNA from things it comes into contact with, such as bowel cancer cells. Australia has one of the highest rates of bowel cancer in the world, with 1 in 15 developing the disease. It's our second deadliest cancer, resulting in more than 6,000 deaths annually. Early diagnosis is the key. Cancer researcher, Associate Professor Susan Woods, is a biomedical scientist at the University of Adelaide. She established her gut cancer research group at the South Australian Health and Medical Research Institute in 2019. The world-first discovery by Susie and her SA-led team puts Australia on the cusp of an amazing new field of cancer detection and treatment. Hello, my name's Ron Cantelars. I'm a freelance journalist and producer. And throughout this series, we've been canvassing a range of topics, touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland, and Western Australia. Also in the studio with me is Vicky Thompson, the CEO of the Group of Eight universities. Well, firstly, to you, Associate Professor Susan Woods, this breakthrough in bowel cancer research really stems from the use of an engineered bacteria. What is it and how do you use it to detect bowel cancer?
Okay, so this engineered bacteria really came about because of a big international collaboration that we have with researchers in San Diego in Jeff Hastie's group there, a really talented postdoc called Rob Cooper. And his job was researching how different bacteria take up bits of DNA, so genetic material, from their environment. So this is a bacteria that lives in the soil, and what it does to cope with changing conditions in the soil is take up bits of DNA from other organisms that also live in the soil, mm-hmm. and that helps it live.
Right.
So the other collaborators that I should mention, I have a very close collaborator with a gastroenterologist called Dan Worthley, who's also a scientist. So clinical focus, but also scientific brain. He traveled to Jeff's group in San Diego and he heard Rob talk. And Rob was talking about these bacteria that take up bits of DNA from their environment. And a lot of what Dan sees in his clinic is videos of people's guts. Mm-hmm. And he's looking for early stages of bowel cancer. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much a lot of what his job entails. And he was sitting there thinking, okay. If we can take bits of DNA from a soil and get a bacteria to take them up, why couldn't that same bacteria find cancer DNA? And mm-hmm. that was sort of the genesis of the idea. And from there, a lot of the work in my group in Adelaide and at SAMRI is about how do we then apply that to models of bowel cancer from patients. So we work a lot with surgeons and medical oncologists and clinical teams in Adelaide. Mm-hmm. So Flinders Medical Centre, Royal Adelaide Hospital, Lyell McEwen, even St Andrews, even into the private system. We have a big network where we're taking samples from patients. So we grow them in the lab. And what we've been doing is trying to test, okay, so Rob in the US made bacteria that could find bits of DNA, okay? So then the critical part that we've done now is said, can we make those bacteria find cancer DNA? And that's a really different idea than had been out there before, because now, even though the bacteria are good at taking up other bits of DNA, we've modified them so they can sense bits of DNA that are important for cancer in people.
Right.
And that's the big difference. So he did that. And then we got those bacteria and we tested them in our lab to say, can they find human cancer DNA? Can they do it actually in the gut? Because then it's really complicated. So there's lots of, you imagine when you eat.
There's a lot going on.
Or your diet.
What's happening?
There's a lot of different microbes that live in your gut. So those bacteria are competing with all the different bacteria. And we really didn't think it would work. I mean, this is a very cool idea that Dan came back from the US and he was talking to us in the lab and trying to think about how we could make it work. And to be honest, I was quite pessimistic. So when it first started working, we just thought this is insane. How does this work? How do these bacteria in this really competitive environment find these particular sequences. So in a nutshell, that's a very long explanation.
So if you were explaining this to a layperson who knows nothing about your field, you know, I mean, what would an analogy be? Is it like a magnet that goes through and attracts things on the journey through? Or is it like a vacuum cleaner that hoovers up stuff on the journey through?
Yeah, very clearly. It's almost like it's reading a newspaper as it goes through. It's looking for particular words.
Yeah.
And those words are very rare. And so it's able just to hook onto that word or that bit of DNA and read it. And the important thing about the bacteria is they can respond as well. So they're not just saying, take it in, do nothing with it. They're saying, take it in and then release a signal to say, I've read that word or I've read cancer and send us a signal that that cancer is present.
And this seems to be so typical of so many breakthroughs with medicine these days, doesn't it? With, you know, as we understand the genome more and more, we find markers, we find things that pick up and amplify or, you know, shine a light on this particular issue, which is what your research has done.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's no point in us just, I guess, there is a point in research that is purely academic.
Yep.
And that says, okay, we can get bacteria to do these things that they couldn't do before. But I guess for me, for sort of the lead scientist in my lab, Josephine Wright, the reason that we're motivated to do this is to find cancer and to provide some sort of outcome for patients in the future that is different to what's happening now.
So can I just take you back to, I think it was you said, Rob in the US who was looking at bacteria in soil. Was he doing that with a view of it being used to detect cancer, or was it a serendipitous kind of journey, as research often is? And it was like, oh, this could do that. And then by bringing other researchers in and postdocs and people like yourself, it's like, well, if it can do that, it might be able to do that. So do you know what he was originally looking for?
Sure. So he was really interested in, so you would have heard about CRISPR, which is, okay, so this is a little bit off topic, is what he was originally working on. So CRISPR is a system that's recently been awarded Nobel Prizes for its discovery, and it's essentially a way that bacteria have of protecting themselves from infection.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's the system, and he was looking at how that worked in the soil bacterium and understanding its defence mechanism and how it could be modified. So the lab in San Diego it's called a synthetic biology lab. Mm-hmm. So they essentially adapt organisms so that they can take up different biological properties that other things have, if that makes sense.
So he's not a medical researcher?
No. So he's essentially, a lot of the people in that lab are actually physicists and mathematicians, but also people that are molecular biologists and take bits of genetic material and make them function in a way that's most useful.
I love this because this is really going to the heart of interdisciplinary research. And, you know, when people say, well, what's the point of doing maths and STEM? We're having people, you know, we're struggling to get kids come through and study STEM. And I'm just thinking of our current chair, almost soon to be departed chair and Nobel laureate, Professor Brian Schmidt, who's always talking about the fact that there are so many interconnected bits to a research team. And it never just starts off with someone going, oh, let's see if we can find something that'll travel through the gut and detect cancer.
Yeah.
It was very serendipitous. And I think that to me is the magic of the research that we do globally and across the Group of Eight in particular, because we do so much of it, that there is not just one person, is there? There's a team of people sitting behind not just the work you're doing, but the work that's obviously happening in San Diego and elsewhere. Yeah. So where could this go? We're talking about gut bacteria and bowel cancer, but could it go further than that?
Yeah, I think we're all entirely inspired by where it could go. And I think we're inspired by, so when Dan first came back from San Diego and he'd spoken to Rob and he was just fizzing and we're thinking, okay, yeah. And it's just incredibly exciting to have that sort of intellectual challenge. I think it's all of us nerdy science type people get together. Where could it go? So for bowel cancer, obviously we're interested in screening people and different ways of screening and can we improve current screening, which maybe we'll get into later about why we're doing it. But for this test, probably at least initially, it might not be as useful for bowel cancer. I think something that gets me really excited is, can we move this into screening for pancreatic cancer? Mm. So pancreatic cancer has abysmal survival, and it's really often because it's diagnosed really late. So people don't have symptoms, and then when they get diagnosed, it's often difficult to do anything. So the thing about the cancer change that the bacteria are sensing is it's actually really high numbers of that change in pancreatic cancer in early cancer or pre-cancers and in the early cancers. So maybe 80 to 90% of patients will have the change that we can detect in them. So that gets me excited. So we apply for funding from the US government as well as in Australia, and we've been successful recently in getting some funding to work on that, developing it for pancreatic cancer detection.
Mm. So it must be amazing personally to be working on something that, you know, because I've heard a lot about pancreatic cancer and what a killer it really is, and a silent killer. But if you were able to nut that problem, that would be a major breakthrough.
Mm. Yeah, it would be. I mean, in terms of screening, like you think, okay, so we have to make the screen first and then we have to think about how we would apply it. So it has to be relatively cheap to do because pancreatic cancer is quite rare. If you're going to screen the population, which is what you'd want to do to be able to find those silent cases where there's no symptoms, thinking about how we would actually apply that, I think obviously we'd need help from, you know, public health type experts and other people outside of our expertise, but that would be exciting. I think using bacteria is relatively cheap.
Yeah.
To produce them.
Yeah. So getting back to bowel cancer and looking at the ways in which you do testing, how does this approach make the testing for bowel cancer easier compared to the older and more awkward approaches using stool testing, those sorts of things? Yeah. Is this a bit of a, you know, a leap forward in terms of simplicity?
So that's what we're hoping. That's why we're doing it. So I don't want to dissuade anybody from doing current bowel cancer testing. It's great. It works. It saves lives. I mean, that's why we have it as population screening. When you ask people, I mean, the problem with it is that less than half of the people that are eligible actually do the test.
Why do you think that is?
Well,
so guilty as charged when it was first sent out several years ago now when I've turned 50, but guilty as charged. And when the next cycle came around, I thought, oh, I better do it because someone in my family had it.
Yeah.
So I could probably answer my own question, but it's, and now, you know, you're on that path, but it just seems to me, why are we so reticent?
Well, everyone's busy.
Icky. Yeah.
Yeah. So when asked, what are the main reasons why people don't do it? It's actually because they're scared of the outcome. They don't understand it, or yes, they don't like manipulating their own stool.
Yeah.
So that was, I guess, the other reasons why people don't do it are more of a marketing exercise. So the Jody Lee Foundation does an amazing job of going into workplaces and trying to get people to take up the test. And there are other initiatives like that that are really just about education.
Yeah.
Because if people don't know what the envelope is, they're like, oh, what is this? Why do I need to do it? Unless you know somebody or there's a history or unfortunately a lot of people have actually been touched by bowel cancer, so they understand why you do it.
Well, it's one in 15 Australians will develop bowel cancer.
It's one of our most common and most deadly cancers.
Yeah.
So.
And do we know why it is so prevalent in Australia? It's more prevalent here than elsewhere, isn't it?
Was it 6,000 a year, I think, die from bowel cancer every year? Yeah.
Yeah. There's quite a few reasons put forward about why. I'm not an epidemiologist, so I'm sorry, it's a little bit outside my area of expertise, but what do we know are the risk factors? So obviously diet, how much you exercise, what's in your diet. So high fiber is obviously good for you. A lot of charred meat is not great. Smoking's not good. If you're overweight, that also increases your risk. So all those sorts of things, history in your family of bowel cancer, those things are things that would make you want to be checked more regularly.
And so with this engineered bacteria, do you consume it in a pill? Is that the long-term aim, that it's as simple as that? And then you have blood tests that will, you know, having done its work and located these various markers, these will show up in blood tests. Is that the approach?
So that's our dream scenario. Yeah. Because a blood test or a urine test, I think most people... Yeah, so they would take the engineered bacteria as a pill. And then most people are quite happy to have a blood test or urine test is actually quite easy to do in a clinic visit, whereas stool is obviously something that you need to do at home, can give you more reasons to procrastinate and not do it. So if we can move to one of those other modalities, so the great thing about the bacteria is because they can be engineered to release a signal in other, not this project, but other projects we've been working with our collaborators, and they can get the bacteria to make a signal that is released into the urine. And we've shown that that can work quite effectively. So that's where we're going is,
And I suppose this is a big quantum change in terms of the age groups that you can look at as well, because as you mentioned, you know, it's at 50 that you get the kit, but there must be a lot of young people that just aren't detected. And the problem with this disease is the lack of detection is the thing that that kills you ultimately, you know. So it's that simplicity would then mean that you could access a lot of younger Australians.
Yeah, so hopefully, I mean, so the guidelines in Australia are actually screening from 45. The populations, the free test you get from the government only starts at 50. But if you're concerned or just motivated to check yourself, you can ask for a kit from 45. Yeah, the somewhat scary thing is that for reasons we don't entirely understand, young people are getting bowel cancer more commonly. And so the incidence in young people is actually increasing, which is quite scary. And probably that's linked
in Australia,
to diet. Linked to diet and
lifestyle.
Yeah, lifestyle changes. Although we're not 100% sure exactly why. But so there will be more people coming through with bowel cancer. And unfortunately, because young people, if you present to your GP as a young person, it's not the first thing in the GP's mind, which is fair enough, to check for bowel cancer. So quite often they're diagnosed late. And so then they have more advanced disease when they present. And so then they're less likely to be able to be cured.
Yeah. And so when do you see this potential pill or urinary test being made available?
Unfortunately, it is just the early stages. So this is the first demonstration that this idea could even work. So unfortunately, we're a ways away from giving this to people. But don't you worry, we're like little ducks with our feet pedalling away under the surface.
Have we had clinical trials of it?
No.
Okay, so that's sort of down the track a little bit.
But you are proof positive of what goes on in the cheese grater building. You know, that you know, we drive past it.
Remembering this is a national podcast, you may need to explain to people what the cheese grater building is.
So. Well, here in Adelaide, it's definitely, you know, it's the cheese grater. It's, I think it's a great looking building, but it's got a very unique, singular sort of design. But but it's proof of what's going on in there. It's quite remarkable.
There's look, and if you have time in other podcasts, there's a lot of other great stories that come out of that building.
Absolutely. I suppose it's also potentially, you know, hopefully it's an incredible success, but it points to other discoveries like, you know, Gardasil from the University of Queensland, you know, which has had enormous success. Do you see this as potentially eradicating bowel cancer?
So I think we're on the path to that. I think that living therapeutics, so engineered bacteria in lots of different forms, are going to just really revolutionise healthcare. Are we at the point of eradicating bowel cancer? Not as yet, but look, I think this is a real sort of keystone sort of moment where new treatments and new ways to detect the cancer really are evolving quite quickly.
And we've had Ian Fraser on our podcast. And of course, that wasn't an overnight sensation either. That was years and years and years. And again, a little bit of serendipity in terms of the research that he led up at the University of Queensland. And of course, now it's had such a significant impact on cervical cancer, but also more broadly now. So you can see that some of these things, and I guess that is part of the challenge we have, that the society and funders are a little impatient and finding that patient capital to actually do that long-term research can sometimes be quite challenging. And I know that because, you know, part of my job as CEO of the Group of Eight is to try and ensure that we continue to get research funding for all sorts of research, and in particular health research, which we do a lot of. So you mentioned that you were, I'm assuming it was NHMRC research from the Australian government and other sources, but also US-backed funding as well. So just maybe talk us through how difficult is it to actually secure research funding so that you can keep going that next step?
Well, there's always the chicken and the egg problem, where you have to have, you know, the research that really proves that you can do the research before you can get funded for the research. So the NHMRC, Australian government, has tried to address that with the Ideas Grant Scheme and some more sort of blue sky thinking. And really this project, so it always reminds me of the H. pylori story where that didn't get government funding. Mm-hmm. So the science paper that we've just published, actually we put it up for NHMRC funding twice, and it, so three times. First two times it got knocked back. The third time it got funded. And that was pretty much when we had the science paper almost ready to go. So I think it says possibly a little bit about how we wrote it, that it was such a sort of out there idea that maybe it was hard for people to accept. But it also just is a message to embrace maybe some blue sky thinking really in how we're funding
and stuff. The Helicobacter pylori story I know well because I have had Helicobacter pylori, and Barry Marshall is a Nobel Prize winner. I think out of frustration, he actually infected himself, actually. Mm. Barry Marshall, who and Robin Warren, yes, Nobel Prize winners out of University of Western Australia, another group of eight university. And, you know, he was trying to dispel the myth, and this is my very simplistic way of looking at it, that ulcers were caused by stress. They were actually caused by some other bacteria issue.
Yep.
And he ended up taking what he needed to take to basically create the bacteria in his own stomach. And he does this fantastic, we should get him on a podcast actually, because he does then talk about how his wife was really against it because it made him really sick.
Yeah.
And he didn't know what was actually going to happen because he was his own experiment. Anyway, as it turns out, there is a bacteria which causes gut ulcers and if not treated can lead to stomach cancer. Mm. And having just gone through this myself, is now detected through a breath test.
Right.
It's so easy to actually detect it if you know what you're looking for. So to your point about GPs potentially not going straight to young people with bowel cancer, GPs are not always going straight, as they did in my case. They didn't go straight to that. Mm. So you can have 12 months, as I did, of being very, very ill but not actually knowing what it is when actually it's a breath test and you've got now, you know, you can detect it, you can treat it very quickly and, you know, happy days.
But
he had to do that himself.
Yeah.
To actually then prove that there wasn't, I'm telling the story right, aren't I?
Yeah.
So I guess sort of flippantly what I'm saying to you is, you know, he had to go to a fairly extreme
measure
to be able to then secure the funding, which is now, you know, world leading and now is a cure and we can cure it very quickly.
Well, it's a good time to talk about funding because I know you, Vicky, and the Group of Eight have been definitely pushing government when it comes to, you know, 3% of GDP being allocated for research and development. And this is yet again another example of how hard it is for researchers to get the money that they need. But the impact on daily life is profound.
Life-changing. And, you know, Susie's sitting here. She's one of those researchers. I mean, you know, it's often the case that research sort of every year you're having to secure funding to go for the next year. And we talk about this funding cliff when, and I guess that was my point about that patient capital, as I call it, that the chicken and the egg, proving it so that you can get the research. Mm. And then, of course, when it is a breakthrough, when you do get to where you're going to get, I'm sure you'll get to, it'll be like, oh, this is brilliant. The Australian government's funded this.
It must be very frustrating, though, you know, when you've got to go through this, you know, rounds of funding and you know that you're onto something, but others can't necessarily see it.
There's two parts of me. So I love the intellectual challenge of grant writing and having sort of demarcated time where you think about your idea and you perfect it and you work out how you're going to do it. Obviously, the disappointing part is when you don't get funded for things that you think are really cool. So, you know, that's, but you sign up for this gig.
Although the success rates within NHMRC are pretty low, aren't they? So I know at the ARC they're around 12, 13%. I'm not sure what the figure is for NHMRC, but I don't think 10%. It's much higher. Yeah.
But the Commonwealth has recently recommitted to increasing investment in R&D to, 3% of GDP?
The government has made a commitment to get us to be closer to 3% of GDP.
And it's currently 1.7,
way below OECD averages, which is why, so you're one of the very few researchers I've actually heard say that they like the intellectual challenge of writing grants.
Yes.
Because most of them just want to get on and do the research.
Yeah. So what would, you know, a commitment to 3% mean for people like you?
Well, hopefully it would mean that more of that would get funded.
Yeah.
And so I actually spend less of my time rewriting a grant that didn't quite get up for funding. So this last year I've been quite fortunate in the sense that we were quite successful in the previous years. And so I've essentially written maybe one or two grants in the last year and focused solely on getting stories out and papers out and moving forward with our research. Whereas the previous year, I pretty much spent 90% of my time just writing grants and not doing research.
It's interesting you mentioned getting stories out. How important is it for scientists now to be able to market what they do? You know, get it out to the mm-hmm. broader media, to, you know, TV news, ABC. Mm-hmm. Obviously creates a groundswell where I'm sure others then say, we have to back these people. I saw it on the ABC the other day or whatever.
So I think it depends on the researcher. Some are very successful. I enjoy talking to people about what we do because that's a big part of why we do it, right? So I don't provide the money for my funding. Mm. So the public provides the money for what we do. So I have just an obligation to tell people, but also to excite them. I love in Science Week, I went to a school and talked about what we did. And there was probably about 10 kids at the end of that talk that were just, they were just buzzing.
Yeah.
And they wanted to talk to me and where did you go and what sorts of labs did you work in and how did you do this? And that stuff that's gold.
But isn't that brings up another point though, that I suppose for a lot of people like yourselves, the impression is that, you know, you're in white coats, you're nerds, working in the lab. But at the end of the day, when you get the message across that the stuff that you do changes the lives of those kids' parents in some way because they may have bowel cancer or not know it. Mm-hmm. Well, that then becomes a profound advertisement for everything you do.
Oh, look, I embrace the nerd tag, entirely happy being a nerd. And I think saying that being a nerd is worthwhile and fun and useful, and you don't have to fit in a particular box. If you're a bit different, use that skill set that you've got. Yeah.
Well, long may you continue to use that skill set and keep up the work that you're doing because it's quite remarkable. And thanks very much for your time today.
No worries.
Thanks, Susie.
Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune into the debate at go8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.